At Pluralsight, we don't just teach skills. We are building the tech workforce who deliver results fast, accelerated by top-tier content. Lead with confidence. Lead with expertise. Visit us at Pluralsight.com to tap in and learn more.
Lowe's knows that saving is always top of mind, especially this season. That's why we've picked some great deals for early Black Friday. Get free select DeWalt, Kobalt, or Craftsman tools when you buy a select battery or combo kit. More tools? Why not? Plus, we've got select pre-lit artificial Christmas trees starting at $59.98 because it's never too early to think Christmas. Get Black Friday prices without the crowds. Lowe's, we help you save. While supplies last, selection varies by location.
Let's talk.
John Brown. I've been looking forward to doing this interview for quite some time because Super Squad tells the story of 23 footballers in the 60s and 70s who had the greatest influence on English football and what that means today. Delighted to say that joining me, we've torn away from his Sabutio set, no doubt, Colin Wheeler, the author of Super Squad. Colin, good morning to you, sir.
Good morning to you, girls, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to chat about my book.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it is a period. It is the halcyon period, isn't it, when football was relatively innocent. There wasn't sort of sponsorship. You know, there were iconic kits. I mean, it looks like you've got the Arsenal kit on the front of the cover there, but we forgive you that. And pictures that, you know, pictures that would make a modern-day Ronaldo quiver and fall over and not come out of the changing room.
Exactly that. First of all, I mean, you need to read chapter 23 to find out the story of the Arsenal shirt in the front with the black number 10 on the back. Okay, so but there is a story attached there in chapter 23 around Ray Kennedy. Yes, absolutely. I mean, the point I've made previously is that we lived through the greatest era of English football and we didn't even know it. You know, the guys that were around then, you're talking about, you know, the best, or Charlton, Jimmy Greaves, Bobby Moore, Gordon Banks, those guys were absolutely the best players English football, Scottish football has ever produced, and we didn't know it. And this is the thing, okay, we've had successes since then, we've had other players, Dal Greaves, but he's included as well. But, you know, this idea that we lived through it all, and we were so privileged to watch these players. Cannot underestimate the power of, and the influence of TV as well. Television was in its infancy in terms of, you know, showing football, and we suddenly attached ourselves to it so quickly. And then we had, you know, beyond TV and black and white TV, we had the fantastic super visual of colour TV, and it was transformative. Actually watching a game of football in colour. Anyone that actually was born in that era and actually watched a game of football on TV, then all of a sudden you can watch it on colour TV. It really was. It was a completely different experience.
Because if you think about it, I mean, you know, is it the 67 European Cup with Best? Is that, is it 67 or 68?
68.
Obviously, yeah, there you go. Yeah. With Best. But that's, you always think of that in black and white, don't you? That was,
yes,
because it
absolutely
was. And then suddenly, because the BBC gets colour TV with their huge outside broadcast wagons, and so that it's getting beamed into, you know, the glorious white of Leeds, you know, like I said, the red of Liverpool. But, you know, it's live, it's colour, and and there are players out there who are making it worth watching, to put it mildly.
Yeah, absolutely. The way that, you know, you just brought up a really good point. BBC showed the European Cup final 1968 in black and white. And do you know what? They actually showed the FA Cup final in colour. I just thought of that. It was strange that they were bringing in colour TV very gradually. I think they would only have selected events that would actually be broadcast in colour. FA Cup final was, European Cup final wasn't. But yeah, it was just sort of, it was the way that it was. And, you know, I actually make reference to that in my introduction. You know, yellow and blue are my favourite colour combination, because first ever cup final I watched in colour. was Arsenal versus Liverpool 1971. That colour combination has never ever left me. Fantastic.
Talking yellow and blue, I know it's not exactly English football, but if you're saying to say a defining moment that is colour and football, 1970 World Cup, you know, Brazil, Italy, the glorious Mexican sun, and it's, I mean, look at it now, it's saturated with colour. And I know it's not, yeah, but that, and that, from that point onwards, everything is pretty much in colour, you know, including the scraps between sort of Keegan and Bremner. It's wonderful stuff.
but most people, you know, over 80% of the population would have watched that fantastic World Cup in black and white, you know, and then it's afterwards, then you found out it was recorded in colour, and then you would have seen it, you know, when you got a colour TV, then you would have seen the highlights of it later. But most people watched that live experience in black and white.
Right, so we've dealt with the colour issue. That's pretty good in the first 5 minutes. I grew up in Stoke-on-Trent, and the Stoke country, and it was sort of a thing that footballers, when they retired from the game, they just ran pubs in the Midlands, you know, didn't they? They didn't become pundits. They didn't go on the, you know, I'm thinking about those big matches, you know, that we covered, the FA Cup, which used to get the whole day, the wives in the outfits. I mean, the build up. I mean, now it's like, okay, wow, FA Cup's on in 5 seconds time, but it was that whole, the wives in matching outfits and matching hairdos. I mean, completely incorrect. It's looking back at a special time, isn't it, Colin?
It is. And don't forget, in those days, there was only three games of football that were broadcast live. There was the FA Cup final, there was the England-Scotland home international, and the European Cup final. So that was your treat. Yeah, the first game of the year that was actually broadcast live was the FA Cup final, which is why families sat near, settled down for the whole of the day to enjoy the whole immersive experience. You know, it, watching a game of football, the build-up to everything was just incredible, you know, on a colour TV. It was a whole family day. Of course, with sport now, because there's a live match on telly every single day, and at least one.
Yeah. The book deals with, you know, as I say, the sort of the players who transform football. And it's not just about the greats, isn't it? So what was your, if you like, what was your criteria for selecting the players?
The players I've already mentioned, they are the standout world-class players. You have to include them because they did with the game on anyway. But then there was the ones that I think should have, you know, my personal favourites. Okay, fair enough. But I think there's always one or two that you've forgotten or you discarded, you attached a bad name to, but we're actually, what I want to do is try and rebrand them, if you like. There's one player there called Ian Yaw, who used to play for Arsenal, and he got a bad reputation. He was a bit agricultural, and, but when he came down to...
When you say a bit agricultural, sorry, Colin, that's a wonderful expression. What, I mean, did he have a cult, did he have a, you know, a tractor behind him? Did he go in at head height, or, you know, like a strimmer on steroids?
If you can imagine Tony Adams, sort of mid-80s, before Tony Adams became a very, very good player, Tony Adams was a bit raw. Mm. And I think we can put it down to that. There's a rawness about Ian Yaw that marks him out as, you know, a very, very aggressive centre-half. And he made a couple of high-profile mistakes in televised games that people never forgot about. But, you know, when a guy came down to England in 1967, he played in the home internationals against England in 63. Scotland had beaten England 2-1 at Wembley. And Kenneth Wilson-Holm, no less than Kenneth Wilson-Holm, who was the guy commentating, you know, 1966 World Cup final, I think it's all over. Kenneth Wilson-Holm described Ian Yaw as the best centre-half in the world. Now, what happened? He got a very bad injury at Arsenal, never recovered. And as it was in those days, injuries weren't treated properly. They were just, you injected cortisone into a badly damaged knee, you get him out on the pitch, and it makes it even worse. You know, sort of those up. There was no proper rehabilitation. So anyway, he ended up playing with a knackered knee for a long time. And he just got worse and worse as he got on his career progressed. But, you know, I think that... And so the other thing that happened, he made his name on TV before that, outside of football. not before his, but during his career at Arsenal, there's this quiz program in the 60s called Quiz Ball. And it was games, it was teams of football teams against each other, competing against each other, general knowledge quiz. But Ian Muir stood out. You know, he actually looked as if he had a brain, and he could answer questions on not just about football. He could answer questions on general knowledge. So it already establishes a reputation. I think the point I tried to make is that, you know, this guy was known on TV before to a wider audience than just a football audience. And then what are some other players? Sort of John McGovern at Forest. You know, the guy was twice captain of the European Cup winning side, never once capped for Scotland. You know, how did that happen?
There used to be this legion of Scottish players coming down. I mean, the backbone of every English team was a Scots. Oh, yeah. You kind of think what's happened to that, because
I know. That's why the other thing is that the Scottish League has been there's a lot more foreign players in the Scottish League as well as the English League.
Yeah.
So there are fewer Scottish standout players, if you like. The ones that obviously do come down and stand out, that they, you know, Andy Robertson, Liverpool, Scott McTominay. Is that an issue now? Is he playing for? Is it Roma?
Anyway, I think it's Roma.
He's had a great season out there. He's really, really appreciated. The talent's still there. It's just there's not as many of them, I think. But then you might say about English football.
But the thing is, obviously, now we're in a situation where the money's so good that they will, you know, they're attracting players from all over the world. And whilst that's great for the spectacle for the Premier League, that sort of backbone coming down from, you know, the English talent, the Welsh talent, and the Scottish talent isn't being developed. I mean, it's all about the money. And I remember the outcry when Trevor Francis was the first million pound footballer. I mean, does the book sort of chart the money coming into the game, as it were?
The closest we get to it really is the chaps on Jimmy Hill. That does go into. Well, Jimmy Hill, first of all, okay, so he ended his football career in 1961. Then, and at the time, he was the chair of the Professional Football Association, which was massively influential. They were going to call a player's strike because they wanted the maximum wage abolished. The maximum wage at that time meant that didn't matter how good you were, if you played English football, you got 20 quid a week and that was it. That's all you got, 20 quid a week. Okay. So the maximum wage was abolished, and all of a sudden you had the first ever English football player called Johnny Haynes, who started to earn £100 a week at Fulham. Now, that paved the way. You know, the instigation started there. You know, £100 a week, that's it. You know, there's no limit. Then all of a sudden, soon, you know, we've been sort of 10, 15 years, players were getting, you know, £500 a week, £1,000 a week, bit by bit. Charlie Nicholas, when he signed for Arsenal in 1983, £2,000 a week. You know, wow, yeah, where's that come from? That was it. The gates were open, essentially. So the chapter on Jimmy Hill does, you know, it touches upon. That's where it all started, if you like. Once we abolished the maximum wage, once you started getting transfers, big transfers, and then the game changed.
Yeah, indeed. And it's, you know, as I said before, there's an awful lot of, you mentioned the effect that, you know, getting rid of the maximum, getting rid of the maximum wage does. But, you know, it talks about some pioneers. I mean, when you think of pioneers, I mean, who are we talking about there? Are we talking about the best or the Charltons or the Dalglishes?
Because they changed the way the game is played. You know, we've never seen someone as skillful. We'd never seen someone like Colin Bell at Man City. Basically, he could run all day and be a skilled football player. You know, if you're talking about sort of the transformation of when football became a game of 11 athletes on the pitch, look no further than Colin Bell. He was the one that actually, he was the first one, if you like, who could run for 90 minutes and highly skilled. And you know, my personal favourite is Danny Blanchflower. Danny Blanchflower had this great intellectual capacity. He was a very, very clever, articulate guy. And you never, ever see that in football anymore. You know, sort of, there's no one go-to player that every single TV company wants to go to have an interview with, because they're so articulate, you know, say something that's, you know, quite remarkable about the insight on the game. And I think, you know, that'd be lovely to actually sort of have a go-to player or go-to few players, you know, that we're talking through a game.
But the problem is, because we're in a world of corporate and media training, they have to say the same thing again and there is so much money washing around there. You only have to think about, what is it, the Spanish international who had the whole problem with his boots against Spurs. He just got a massive deal with Puma and it's all gone, you know,
they can't say anything wrong. They have to play it safe, don't they?
So, yeah, every team is a challenge and they have respect and et cetera, even if you're beating, I don't know, old Wastonians boys team from Moldova or something. Who's your favourite player then out of this lot? My favourite player from that sort of era is somebody like Ray Kennedy, who stuck at it all, you know, and was overlooked an awful lot of time and was an absolute brilliant servant.
No, you know, likewise, Ray Kennedy for me was—he was my second hero. It was George Best was the first hero, and then the chapter on Ray Kennedy tells you the story from a personal point of view. Is I went off George Best very quickly, and then as Ray Kennedy became my hero, and the reason it was an age thing. I was seven; I didn't know any other football players that were close to my age, and all of a sudden I found out that Ray Kennedy was 19. You know, sort of relatively, he was very young. And so I attached myself to him. And, you know, it was a good choice. Fantastic guy, you know, sort of really, and later struggles with Parkinson's particularly. But he always remained my hero. And it was, just a fantastic player. But actually writing the book, I came across, you know, players that would, you know, were my new heroes. Finding my new heroes as a, you know, in my 50s, my late 50s, how did that happen? Because you love football, that's why. And I think Jack Charlton is the one that stood out for me. Fiercely intelligent man. Great lover of football. Real sort of a dyed-in-the-wool football man, he really was. The more you read about him and the influence in the game, fantastic guy, he really was.
Didn't suffer fools gladly either. Very committed.
He did not.
What are you hoping that people are going to take from Super Squad?
Just, you know, my infectious love of football, I think. Just read the book and you just get an idea about sort of what football meant to me. Just rub off a little bit on other people, just sort of, okay. And then what will happen, you might want to buy Super Squad 2 and Super Squad 3. Because I do want to write the trilogy. I want the next book to be 70s, 80s, and the next book after that be 80s, 90s. I think that's.
And then afterwards, we just sort of throw it in the. Yeah, after 1996, that's it, basically. It's all kind of over.
That's where football ended.
Yeah, pretty much so, anyway. If people want to follow you on the socials, Colin, is there a website? Do you TikTok?
Okay, I'm on Facebook, but there's a fantastic site called Football in the 60s and 70s, which is run by a guy called Edward Elishak, and it's fantastic. It really is full of our members. There's plenty of, you know, football sites dedicated to that era, but my favourite, where I got involved in, you know, reminiscing about football, I suppose, football in the 60s and 70s, and say I'm on Facebook. What else do I do? I am on not TikTok. What's the other one?
Instagram, perhaps.
Instagram.
That's the one. Yeah. But listeners will be able to order the book via our own virtual bookstore, which I urge them to do, so at least we can get Colin back onto Super Squad 2, the return of the Super Squad, or the Super Squad Strikes Back, or Strikers Back, whatever you want to put in any Star Wars
Absolutely.
Reference.
Yeah.
Colin, it's been great to sort of walk down that turnstile, that nostalgic turnstile with you. The kits were great. I mean, the kits were great stuff, weren't they? You look at them
and
now.
And cotton, weren't they, as well?
I know, because I just remember this. The Sabutia games with the whole league thing. Was it Ajax, or could it be some team out of, you know, second division France? You know what I mean? Colin, the book is called Super Squad. It's by Colin Millen. Colin, it's been absolutely brilliant to speak to you today.
Thank you so much, Charles, for the chance to plug my book, and lovely chat to you as well. Thank you.